Say I'm developing a veterinary protocol for, I don't know, for horses. Should I start by trying it in pigeons? Anthony Dresden asked. He was a handsome man and radiated charisma like a fire shedding heat. Protogen's intake facility looked more like a high-end medical clinic than an administrative office. Small, individual rooms with medical bays, auto docks, and a glass wall facing a nurse's station outside, able to look in on them all, panopticon style. The company logo and motto, first, fastest, furthest, were in green inlay on the walls. The language in my contract mentioned a properly supervised medical performance regimen, and I assumed this had to do with that. But it still felt odd. I'd probably recommend trying it in horses, I said. Why? Because that's the animal you're trying to develop a protocol for? I said, my voice turning up at the end of the sentence as if it were a question. Dresden's smile encouraged me. The pigeon data wouldn't tell me just as much? No, sir. Pigeons and horses are very different animals. They don't work the same ways. I agree. So do you think animal testing is ethical? Of course it is, I said. Why? The sharpness of the word unnerved me. My belly tightened and I found myself plucking at my hands. We need to know that drugs and treatments are safe before we start human testing, I said. The amount of human suffering that animal testing prevents is massive. So the ends justify the means. That seems a provocative way to phrase it, but yes. Why not for horses? I shifted. The wax paper on the examination table crinkled under me. I had the sense that this was a trick, that I was in some kind of danger, but I couldn't imagine any other answer. I don't understand, I said. That's okay, Dresden said. This is an intake conversation, purely routine. Do you think a rat is the same as a human being? I think it's often close enough for preliminary data, I said. Do you think rats are capable of suffering? I think there is an absolutely and ethical obligation to avoid any unnecessary suffering. Not the question. Are they capable of suffering? I crossed my arms. I suppose they are. But their suffering doesn't matter as much as ours, Dresden said. You seem uncomfortable. Did I say something to make you uncomfortable? At the nurse's station, a man glanced up, catching my gaze, and then looked away. The auto dock in the wall chimed in a calm tritone. I don't see the point of the question, sir. You will, he said. Don't worry about it. We're just getting a baseline for some things. Pupil dilation, eye movement, respiration. You're not in any danger. Let me make a suggestion. Just see how you respond to it. All right? The idea that animal suffering is less important than human suffering is a religious one. It assumes a special creation, and that we, you and I, are different in kind than other animals. We are morally separate from rats or horses or chimps, not based on any particular physical difference between us, but just because we claim that we're sacred by our nature and have dominion over them. It's a story we tell that lets us do what we do. Consider the question without that filter, and it looks very different. You said there's an ethical obligation to avoid unnecessary suffering. I agree. That's why getting good data is our primary responsibility. Good experimental design, deep data sets, parallel studies whenever they don't interfere. Bad data is just another way of saying needless suffering. And torturing rats to see how humans would respond? It's terrible data because rats aren't humans any more than pigeons or horses. Wait, so are you saying that skipping animal testing entirely and going straight to human trials is more ethical? We are the animal we're trying to build a protocol for. That's where we'd get the best data, and better data means less suffering in the long run. More human suffering, maybe, but less suffering overall. and we wouldn't have to labor under the hypocrisy of understanding evolution and also pretending there's some kind of firewall between us and other mammals. That sounds restful, don't you think? The autodoc chimed again. Dresden looked at it and smiled. Great. So tell me only the good things you remember about your mother. At my horrified look, he smiled and waved the comment away. No, I'm joking. I don't need to know that. Dresden turned to the glass wall and gestured. A young woman in a lab coat, with a stethoscope around her neck like a torque, came in and guided me gently back to prone. As she did, Dresden leaned against the wall, casual and at ease. This is part of our proprietary research regimen, he said. Performance enhancement strategies. The thing that gives us our edge. Looking back now, I believe I felt something like fear in that moment. A sense that important decisions were being made that I was only dimly aware of. Dresden's smile and the doctor's nonchalance seemed to belie that feeling, but for a moment I almost demanded that they stop, that they let me leave. I'm not sure if that memory is true, but fear tends to be the thing I feel and remember most acutely now. So that leads me to believe it is. Before I could act on my fear, the doctor leaned in close to me. She smelled of lilacs. You might feel a little odd, she said. Can you please count backward from 20? I did. The autodoc clicking and shifting on the wall as the numbers grew smaller and smaller. At 12, I stuttered, lost myself. The doctor said something, but I couldn't make sense of her words or find any of my own. Dresden answered her, and the ticking stopped. The doctor smiled at me. She had very kind eyes. Sometime later, a minute, an hour, language came back to me. Dresden was still there. The preliminary we're doing here is magnetic. It suppresses some very specific, targeted areas of your brain. Reduces fixity. Some of our staff finds that it helps them see things they wouldn't have otherwise. It feels... I know, he said, tapping his temple. I did it too. I sat up. A feeling of almost superhuman clarity washed through me. A calm like the sea after a storm smoothed my muscles. It was better than all the drugs I'd taken at the university. The focus of the nootropics, the euphoria of the sedatives. I remember thinking at the time, oh, this could get addictive. Whatever fear I might have felt no longer seemed important. It's nice, I said. So tell me, he said, is animal testing ethical? Or does it make more sense to skip to human trials? I blinked at him, and then I laughed. I remembered the distress I'd felt when he'd asked the same thing just minutes before, but I no longer experienced it. A clarity and calm took that space for its own, and the relief felt joyful. Like I just heard the punchline to the best joke ever. I couldn't stop giggling. That was the moment I became research. I have never regretted it. Necessity, they say, is the mother of invention. But it is the mother of any number of other things as well. Sacrifice and monstrosity and metamorphosis. Necessity is the mother of all necessary things, to coin a tautology. I gave my permission to make the change permanent that afternoon, without ever dipping back into my previous cognitive states. I didn't miss or want them. Excitement fizzed in my belly. Freedom, as I'd never known it, sang in my blood. A burden I hadn't known I was carrying vanished, and my mind became sharper, able to reach into places that shame or guilt or neurosis would have kept me from before. I didn't want to be what I had previously been, any more than a depressive would long for despair. And anyway, as Dresden said, we at Protogen weren't concerned with remaking the destiny of rats and pigeons. I left Earth for the first time when I shipped to Phoebe. All I knew of the planets and dwarf planets and moons that made the habitable human system, Mars, Ceres, Pallas, Ganymede, I learned from watching the feeds. The politics of the alliance between Earth and Mars, the dangers posed by the Outer Planets Alliance and other Belter resistance groups. The story of mankind's torturous reach out into the vast emptiness of the system formed a complex story that felt as removed from my experience as the crime dramas and musical comedies that appeared on the same feeds as the news. Phoebe Station wasn't even among that number. An obscure moon of Saturn, it began as a cometary object that found itself trapped by the gas giant's gravity as it passed by, presumably from the Kuiper Belt. It stood out from the other moons, 4 times as far from the planet as the next nearest. Its retrograde orbit and the lamp-black darkness of its surface gave it a sense of menace. Phoebe, the ill-omened moon, the alien weapon. Tucked within the planetesimal's icy layers, the joint research group, Protogen and the Martian Naval Scientific Service, had found tiny reactive particles the size, roughly, of a mid-range virus, but with a design structure and informational depth unlike anything Earth's biosphere had ever imagined. The protomolecule, we called it, branding it immediately in a territorial move that irritated the Martian scientists. We ignored their protests as irrelevant. Our best guess was that it had been sent from some distance we couldn't guess at a time when a defined cell membrane stood as the heights of terrestrial life. The protomolecule appeared to be a message in a bottle, but one that included its own grammar books and instruction tutorials, ready to teach whatever aboriginal cells it found how to become the things it required. We argued whether something as inert as a spore might be intelligent, at least implicitly, but without coming to a conclusion. The first evidence of a tree of life apart from our own enchanted and confounded us. Me. The base itself showed its military origins in its bones. The corridors, hardened to shield us all from the void's vicious background radiation, were in the colors of the Martian Navy. Each hallway bore the identification marks that told installation order, structural specifications, location within the base, and the date on which it needed replacement. The walls sported the same anti-spalling coatings as the ships. The food in the mess tasted of Mars, hot chili peppers, hydroponic fruit, ramen noodles and vacuum-sealed pouches, daily low-G pharmaceuticals. We had no extra space. The rooms I'd had on Basic were larger than the cells I lived in here. A rack of bunks 4 high, with a shared head so small that I braced my knees against the opposite wall every time I used the toilet. Of my 85 kilograms, I felt a little over 3. Exercise took almost 1/3 of the day, the lab 1/3, eating and sleeping and showering in the tight steel and ceramic shower 1/3. The Protogen nanoinformatics team there claimed only 4 seats, Trin, Quintana, Lei, and myself. Mars had a matching number who joined us. The others would join in later when we shifted to Thoth Station, though by then the Martian contingent would no longer be in play. The rest of the research team wasn't more than 50, all told. With our counterparts from Mars and the naval support staff, Phoebe Base was a few 100 people on a black snowball, so far from Earth that the sun would have been no more than the brightest star if we had ever looked for it. If I chose a time in my life to return to, a high watermark, those months on Phoebe would be it. The protomolecule astounded me every day. The depth of information in it. The elegance of its utterly minimal quasi-flagella. The eerie way it self-organized. One day I would convince myself that we were looking at something like a hive of termites. The next, a colony of mold spores. The next, neurons in a weird distributed brain. I struggled to find analogies, to make what I saw in the scanners fit into what I already knew. Every night I slipped into my bunk, strapping myself down with wide padded straps to keep from throwing myself out with an unintentional twitch, and thought of what I'd seen and heard, what tricks the protomolecule had performed that day. We were, all of us in research, quivering with the sense of being just a moment from revelation. When the news came from Dresden's office of the second and third phase plans, I felt like the universe had leaned down and kissed my cheek. The opportunity to see what the protomolecule chose to do with large-scale structures was the best thing I could have imagined. The prospect filled me to the point of spilling over, and then filled me some more. We killed the Martians in the middle of my work shift. It had all been plotted out, of course, planned in back channels where our partners wouldn't hear us. When the moment came, I left my desk, moving toward the head, but paused to key in the override sequence. The Martians didn't notice anything. Not right away. And by the time they did, it was too late. We infected them and trapped them in a sealed level 4 containment lab. Watching the initial infection stages work on humans set the course for everything that would come later. But we couldn't afford to let the transformation fully run its course in a location we didn't control. So once we had our early stage data, we gassed them and then burned the bodies. When the Anubis arrived to retrieve the team and our precious samples, I walked to the dock with an odd wistfulness, but also with a sense of anticipation. On the one hand, I'd loved my time there, and I would never again walk through these corridors. On the other, the experiment rising on my personal horizon promised to crack open everything we understood about the universe. I anticipated seeing the fascinating little particles arrange themselves, expressing layers of implicit information like a lotus eternally blooming. When the ship left, the plume of our fusion drive finished sterilizing the base. The dataset we took from the infected Martians, while interesting and evocative, suffered from a relatively small absolute biomass. Phoebe Base was smaller than a city elementary school, and our analyses strongly suggested that the protomolecule went through behavioral phase changes with increased mass as profound as a switch between states of matter. In the ship burning toward Thoth Station, the team sat in the galley, putting up models to show how the men and women we'd recently shared meals and sometimes bunks with had been infected, disassembled, and repurposed into larger-scale tools to express the protomolecule's same underlying information structure. Trin maintained that her data scheme outperformed Quintana's, and she did so with a ferocity that ended with her stabbing a fork into his thigh and being confined to quarters. There were also rumors of assaults among the other research groups, the natural expression, I thought, of the excitement and stress we had all been under. I was almost certainly projecting, but I couldn't help comparing us to our subject. All of us in research had become exotics, and with time and changing environments, we, like it, would reassemble and reconfigure and become something unpredictable and possibly glorious. We had almost reached the flip and burn at the middle of our transit when it occurred to me that the vast sorrow I had carried with me since the day my mother dropped the glass was gone. I could think of her now without weeping, without wanting to bury myself in activity or anesthetize myself with drugs. I didn't know if it was because I had finished the natural progression of grief, or if the process of becoming research had burned the ability to feel that guilt and horror out of me. Either way, it was a good sign.